Welcome to the Trade Show Podcast, the home for conversations with global leaders in the trade show and events business. Our show will bring you face to face with experts who speak about the possibilities and trajectories of this $50 billion industry. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make conversion easy. Welcome to this episode of the Trade Show Podcast. Thank you for listening and your continued feedback. If you have suggestions or you want me to dig in with a specific guest, please write to me at shubhanjan@pitch.link or message me on LinkedIn. Both links available in the show notes. I'm very excited to introduce you to our guest today, Tahira Endean, Head of Program IMEX. She is the author of Intentional Event Design, Our Professional Opportunity, and Our KPI is Joy, Using Live Events to Catalyze Happiness, Productivity, and Trust. She's also the co-founder of Strategy Table, helping companies transform team dynamics through expert meeting facilitation.
If people don't leave your event feeling more connected to your brand and that you have given them the colleagues, the leadership, and the product and the tools to sell that product, they're not going to sell it. They don't sell. You don't have a company. So it's very correlated that you need to connect to the humans at your events.
Tahira Endean is the head of program IMEX. She's the author of Intentional Event Design, Our Professional Opportunity, and Our KPI is Joy, Using Live Events to Catalyze Happiness, Productivity, and Trust. She's also the co-founder of Strategy Table. Tahira is a curious event designer and curator of education for the MICE industry. She's passionate about global travel, intentional event design, and the integration of technology into our lives and events to enhance the human experience. Tahira wore her association hat as head of events for Sight from 2019 through the pandemic and until we returned to events fully in 2023. Change is inevitable, and in 2023, Tahira put her passion for lifelong learning into practice to earn an MSc in Creativity and Change Leadership. Tahira continues to educate the next generation, teaching event strategy and design at the British Columbia Institute of Technology. Deeply committed to the industry, Tahira has been recognized for a range of contributions, including 2022 Influencers with North Star Meetings, Smart Meetings Woman in Meetings Visionary 2021, Meetings Today Top 20 Trendsetter 2018, A Meetings Net Changemaker 2016, the MPI BC Chapter Mentor of the Year 2018, amongst others. In 2015, Tahira was included into the Meetings Canada Hall of Fame in the Big Idea category. Driven by a fascination with what we are learning about neuroscience and the power of the five senses to enhance memory, knowledge retention, and improve connections, she's continually seeking appropriate ways to design the most relevant incentive, meeting, and event environments. Tahira also loves travel, cooking, time with her family, and anything with bubbles. Now, on to this insightful session with Tahira Endean. Hello, Tahira. Welcome to the Trade Show Podcast. I'm delighted to have you with us this morning. I'm so thankful that you took time to schedule me early in the morning and join me from Canada. I spend quite a bit of time every year in Canada, and it's incidental that at this point I'm not there. I'm in the other side of the world.
Yes. What part of Canada do you spend time in?
Between Toronto and Calgary.
Okay.
So I'm very intrigued. What made you write this book? I mean, how did you even arrive at the idea that joy should be a KPI for events?
Well, I have been planning events since the 1990s. And producing them and watching people interact. And why do people come to events? They come to events to be together. In whatever capacity that is, whether you are at a festival, a conference, a, you know, small round table. It doesn't matter what it is. When you come together, you are coming together for a purpose, or you should be coming together for a purpose if you've done it well. So in 2017, I was looking at, somebody had asked me about an article I'd written. I couldn't find it. I thought, this is ridiculous. I have all of the stuff that I've written and I don't even know where it is. So and there were some things that I felt quite strongly about in our industry that we weren't necessarily doing that well, really being purpose-driven and people-centric, and that information on how to do that better could be accessed in one place. And so I wrote Intentional Event Design, Our Professional Opportunity. At the end of 2021, as we were coming out of the pandemic and changing events and changing events and changing events, I went back to that book and thought, oh, it's going to be terrible. It's not going to be useful anymore. And I reread it and I was like, no, this is still 100% exactly what we should be doing, and added 8 pages in a 2022 version on things we'd learned from the pandemic about how people wanted to meet differently. And then I was just kept thinking, this isn't enough. And so I was in the midst of doing a master's degree in creativity and change leadership. And I thought, you know, I've always thought that with events that we are the engineers, but our leaders are the architects of whatever change we're trying to achieve with that event. Mm-hmm. And so there had to be some link between leadership and event design, intentional event design. And so I talked to my, you know, as I started to work on what my final project was going to be for my master's, I just kept trying to put this together and talked to my advisor. And she's like, well, write a book proposal. And I was like, that's a great idea. Do I want to write another book? Well, I don't know. It feels like a lot of work. And so then as I started developing it, I thought, no, this is something that needs to be out there. It's something that, you know, we always talk about in events, how do we get a seat at the table? Hmm. How do we get our voices heard? How do we get, because what often happens in the world of events is I am going to produce your event or a series of events for you. I'm going to produce a series of events over the course of a conference. And it, you know, everything from, you know, your welcome and arrival experience to your opening general session that gets everybody excited into all of your sessions and hopefully some final closing with some lovely peak and end moments. And through that whole process, I might never speak to the senior stakeholder. Mm. I might speak to layers of people in between. But at the end of the day, the layers of people in between are only going to be happy with you if their senior stakeholders are happy. So it's, what do the senior stakeholders want? Well, they want the same thing everybody wants. They want to come to an event and they want to enjoy their experience. Even if that experience takes you through, and probably sometimes even more, if that experience takes you through some kind of deep transformation, then it becomes even more important that we're designing for that experience to be psychologically safe, meaningful, and at the end that you find some peace, joy, happiness, productivity, whatever it is that's going forward. To, on a different kind of scale, you know, you might be planning their national sales conference where you're going to have, you know, 1 to 10,000 people in a room or a series of rooms and series of experiences, 3 to 5 days, quite often. And you need them to leave feeling happiness, productivity, you know, that they can be more productive because of the tools you've given them during that sales conference, and that they trust in where they work. And ultimately, that comes down to a feeling of joy. And so I wrote the proposal, got a great mark. That was good. Finished my master's, started writing the book. So that between May and November, I was writing the book from November of 2023 for a very long period of time, up until mid-2024, we lost 12 peers, colleagues, family, and close friends. And it was very difficult. While I clearly understand that you can't have joy without sorrow, I just didn't feel like writing about joy. And so I stopped for a while, and then eventually I was ready to start again. And then at that point, it became for me even more of an imperative as you know, everything started to really shift in the world to get it out there that we have a lot of power with events and what we're doing to create places where we can come together and find some joy. So that's the very long story of the genesis of the book.
Well, not really. I mean, I think I'm sort of trying to grasp the emotional pieces that went behind what you just told me, and connecting it to events, and which is a very commercial thought fundamentally, right? Not to say that emotion has no place in buying and transaction and so on. There's a lot, as we know, but that's not what we acknowledge or we like. We really don't talk in terms of putting up a conference and what's the emotional investment that my salespeople are going to make in this conference, right? I mean,
And how much of a miss is that?
Exactly.
It's everything. If people don't leave your event feeling more connected to your brand and that you have given them the colleagues, the leadership, and the product and the tools to sell that product, they're not going to sell it. They don't sell. You don't have a company. So it's very correlated that you need to connect to the humans at your events. There's no other, there's just simply no way around that. So I think that it's really important. And I think, you know, what I'm seeing in the industry, which is incredibly satisfying for me, is that the corporate brand marketers, people working in associations, planning meetings, people working on fundraisers, you know, they are, this book is really resonating with them. You know, there was at the beginning, there was a woman who I didn't know at all. So she posted on LinkedIn and she said, you know, I saw this book. It really interested me. So I ordered the book. And then I couldn't wait, so I got it on Kindle. And then I just started, was going to just glance at it. And then 3 hours later, I'd finished the book. And now I'm putting Joy Metrics into my large financial company's event planning documents. That's when we can start to change the world, one event at a time, is when we start to consider not just the all of the logistics, which are super important. We need to know everything that's going to happen. We need to do our contracting, our food, all of those things. But at the end of the day, if we are not actually focused on our participants, you're spending millions of dollars for nothing. So why are we not explaining to our stakeholders? Why are we not asking our stakeholders, what's the emotion you want people to feel when they leave this event? Are we scared? Do we think it'll sound too fluffy? It's not fluffy. Every single element of your event is directed at humans. So consider the humans. I think it's really simple.
Before I dive a little more into the writing process, I want to know, is this specifically for brand events or corporate events and not for large-scale B2B trade shows? Is it something like that?
It can be any kind of an event. You know, it's focused on business events because that's what I do. You know, stay in your lane. So, but it's focused for anyone who is planning any kind of an event where people are going to arrive. Quite simply, so whether that is a brand event, whether it's B2B, B2C, whether it is your association coming together for their annual conference or even their board meeting or their leadership retreat, whether it is for trade shows. Absolutely. There's a ton of trade show examples in the book because I work at a large trade show. I have a lot of examples from that. But, you know, that's one of the many jobs I've had over the years. You know, I've had lot of people tend to go into any industry and sort of stay in a, you know, one particular lane. I've always stayed on the side of planning, producing, leadership change, those types of roles, you know, creating things that are going to bring joy for people, using creativity to do that. And creativity being not just you made something look fabulous, but creativity being how did we help them solve a problem? So really looking at what, where we need to get to, and then how we can use this event to help them get there. And it's, so yeah, anybody who's working on any event where humans show up, your music festivals, your, anything where you need people to feel something, which is every event in the world. So,
yeah, I mean, you are sort of talking of design thinking in many ways.
Yeah.
And we can go into that later. But tell me, what was your, I mean, you did this book proposal, you aced your course. Then what happened? I mean, what was your process? How did you sort of, I would imagine that writing the proposal was simpler than writing the book.
Yes. So, so the first book that I wrote, when I decided that I couldn't find the things that I had written and I thought I would put them together in one book, someone said to me very snarkily, well, you know, you need to have 50,000 words to write a book. I was just like, great. I don't even know what that means. 50,000 words sounds like a lot of words. And so I took everything that I'd written in 2 years, dumped it into a document. This is how not to write a book, by the way. Dumped it into a document. I was like, okay, good. That's a lot of information. I took out all the things that I didn't want to be a perceived expert on because I wasn't the smartest person in a particular area. So took all of that out and then put it together into a highly informational book. And I sent it to my first reviewer, who's known me for a long time as an excellent writer and from our industry. And she, God bless Kathleen, she printed out 300 pages and read them all. And she came back and she said, this is amazing information. It's like your brain has dumped out on paper and it's way too much. Like you need to add stories. You need to make it, you know, I was like, oh, that's good advice. You know? And so we broke it up and now it's, you know, a book that makes a lot of sense. And then this book, when I started writing it, I didn't do any of that. I just started writing. And, you know, again, it was a little bit informational and it still is. I mean, it's, of course, it's, you know, it's meant to be a book that provides some guideposts for people. And, you know, I gave it to a few people to read. There was, you know, people really, they liked the content. You know, people with the early readers were like, they were making notes, they were highlighting it. They were, you know, you could see clearly they were going to use the information, which was fantastic. But again, someone who I know who's an excellent writer and, you know, again, like, thank you, Kit. She's like, it gets good around page 30. I was like, okay. And she was right. And so basically page 30 became page 3. Hmm. And, you know, with this book, I just really wanted to, for sure it shifted because there was so much emotion involved in it. And the experiences, because it took, you know, almost 2 years from the proposal to getting it out into the world to, you know, about 20 months. Some of the examples are very old. And some of the examples are incredibly current. And I think it's important that a lot of the examples, it really actually spans from 5,000 years ago. You know, we, during that time, we also did some trips, I went to Turkey in 2019, I went to Greece in 2023, which both really informed, that we've always wanted to meet. You know, what are Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato known for? They're known for inciting dialogue and gathering groups of people to have discussions. Those were the earliest meetings we still talk about today. You know, I went to Ephesus in Turkey. And, you know, when you walk down this marble road and you see this 200 foot tall library that was built. Ephesus is a city that existed in Turkey from 321 BC to, you know, not very long into AD. So, you know, then you turn down the corner on this marble road and you pass the public bathhouses and the brothels and the homes. And there's this 25,000 seat stadium entirely built out of marble that there are, revitalizing and using again for concerts. But more than 2,000 years ago, there was a stadium for 25,000 people to meet for sport, entertainment, theater. Guess what? We're humans. We've always wanted to meet. We will always want to meet. So, you know, when the world shut down for events in March of 2020, and we had just been to Ephesus, I kept thinking about that stadium. And I was just like, you know what? That was a town that, a city, it was the capital of that region, ceased to exist more than 2,000 years ago. But that stadium is still there. And so this, you know, pandemic is horrible. But we are also going to get past this. And guess what? We're going to want to meet again. So, you know, essentially, we've always wanted to come together and we've always wanted to have an enjoyable time doing that. But we never talk about that. We make that the taboo thing. You know, it's like, oh, it looks like you were just at that conference and it was all just like a big party. Well, for sure, there's parties at conferences. We call them networking events. Then we make them too loud so nobody can actually network. That's another whole chapter. But, you know, we spend a lot of time at events. Meeting, you know, and IMEX is a great example, which is, you know, my day job is working at IMEX, where I do produce the content for IMEX. And so we have about 200, more than 200 conference sessions that happen on top of a trade show, you know, and in America, last year, there was 83,000 one-to-one meetings. So I clearly understand that we want to meet for business. And we want to meet for learning. But what happens all around that is a lot of networking events. And you can't look down a hallway without seeing people hugging. That's what events do. And we need to be good with that. We need to embrace that. And we need to understand their role in our organizational development.
Absolutely. Great points. And as you were telling me about some stories being old in the book, I was just thinking that there is no wrong time to tell the right story, right? I mean, we have been talking about Aesop's fables for how many years? Well, that's a pointer. Stories work. So no denying that. Tell me a little bit about your writing routine. I mean, were you like, you were in the day job, you're writing in the evening, or you're doing it like early morning. What was your pattern?
Well, fortunately, my day job is from 6 till 9 in the morning when I'm available. So I would say my writing is quite flexible as to when I do it. It should. What I would aspire to is to be a much more regular writer. You know, I have a little post-it note that says, beside my desk, it says, every day I will include time to exercise and to write. And most days I find time to do one of those two things. So, you know, once I decided to write again, I just set aside some time every day to write. And I think any writer would tell you it's partly inspiration, but mostly it's the grind of getting it done and focusing and putting the time to it. You know, there's, and I think again, anybody who writes at all would agree with this, that then there's the time that you put it out into the world and send it to those first reviewers and you just want to throw up all the time. You know, once it goes out into the world, you've sort of accepted that, you know, I have another friend who's a writer, Greg, and he said, you know, He's like, well, how did you know when it's done? I said, it'll never be done. Like, if you waited for your book to be done, you would never, ever put it out into the world. So there's just a point where you have to call it and say, okay, this is what is going to go out there now.
Yeah. Makes sense. Let's get into the book. How do you think joy can be measured?
Well, I know that joy can be measured in lots of different ways. So there's, you know, sort of classic surveys. So you can send out a survey at the end of the event. You know, did you enjoy your experience? There is now so many tools for measuring joy in the moment. You know, so there is, you know, there's lots of apps that can do that. But there's, you know, Paul Zak has developed one called Six, which is an app that ties into an Apple Watch or a Fitbit, and it allows you through a day to see where your sort of your peak moments were. So as an event owner, you could bring it to your event. They just did this at MPIWEC. So Bishop McCann worked with this app and, you know, measured people's, you're measuring heart rate and those types of things that come through that device to say, oh, at this time, people were highly engaged. At this time, people had a good time. We've also worked with Zenis to do facial recognition. So it's anonymous facial recognition at events that tells you. So we use it still primarily at things like sponsor activations to see how long people, not just how long people are there, but how their face changes from when they enter the experience to when they leave the experience. And their joy always goes up a little bit, you know, so because activations are designed to activate joy, they're not. You know, we did have a situation a couple of years ago where one of the things that we were measuring was an Ikigai experience that Storycraft and Google's new project had set up. And as people were coming out, they were looking less joyful. What they were actually looking was more serious, because Ikigai is a serious identity experience. So people were coming out looking thoughtful. So we also need to put those things in context of how we're using them. So there are lots of different ways that we can measure joy. It's also understanding that, you know, you want to be measuring joy. So, you know, what I talk about with all events is that they're people-centric and purpose-driven. And so when you're focusing on the people and what your purpose is in there, you're going to arc around joy. Because nobody, like as I said, nobody, we're sending people to events. We're not sending them to war. Yeah. Right? So...
Right. You know, I my day job is something else. I'll not talk about that now, but off the record, I'll tell you later. But basically, I happened to speak to about 200 attendees in various conferences. I mean, there were none of them were brand conferences, but they were all tech or industry, like sustainability kind of thing, right? And unfortunately, and one of the questions I asked them is that what was remarkable for you? And maybe it's the slice, I mean, and this was across like six cities. I mean, Toronto, Calgary, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and so on. And strangely enough, and this is what I got, people said nothing really. Nothing was remarkable.
Does that surprise you really? How many events have you been to in your lifetime that are mediocre? They're good enough.
I mean, I would say 95% of them.
Right.
And the one which are remarkable, they were not even events. It's like going to a Cirque du Soleil, you know. This is in line with your thought about a concert or a sporting event. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm saying Cirque du Soleil is putting up an event every day or twice a day. Those were enjoyable, and lots of memories, and the rest of it that you talk about, the whole experience, right? It's not only about what you're watching and getting stimulated by; it's also how you went in there, and I'm sort of reflecting on the first chapter that you wrote about.
Yes.
So the whole thing matters.
Right? The whole thing matters, right? From the, you know, it starts with anticipation, you know, whether it is a conference or a vacation, you know, how much time do we spend thinking about how good it's going to be versus how good it often isn't. So, you know, it's that's a normal also part of the normal human experience. So what we want to try to do is to get to a place where the anticipation of an event is matched by the event experience itself. And so that your event experience, and you can't in life, you can't be on a high plateau all the time. That's right. Just doesn't make any sense. You know, life and events should have peaks and valleys. They should have high points. They should have remarkable things that you remember. You know, you should meet somebody remarkable. You should taste something remarkable. You should hear something remarkable. You know, you want to find something that is memorable. And if you think about, you know, there's one of the things I talk about in the book as well is, you know, an idea that has been around for a long time. And that for me was, I was really reminded about with the book by Agus Sostick called The Umami Strategy. And, you know, that we have these two selves who come to an event, when the first is the experiencing self and the second is the remembering self. And so this is something that I also talked about in the first book as well, is that we have these, you know, we have something called a recency effect, which is basically we're going to remember what's most recent, and we have a forgetting curve, and our forgetting curve is incredibly high. Our remembering curve is incredibly low. And so if you look at, you know, I always say, you know, I've worked at IMEX for 3 years. I've been to 18 shows. So I went to many, many events before I started working there. And so, and I always, always have said, you know, for me, it always goes by in like a minute and a marathon. You know, it's just, it goes from the minute you enter, it's very busy. There's a lot going on. There's many, many, many high peak moments. So you are there for 4 or 5 days, you know, it's a 3 day plus Smart Monday show. So, plus your pre-time and all of that kind of stuff, but it's, you remember about 6 minutes. Right. So as event organizers, we also need to remember that, like, we don't need to create every moment as a peak, but we do need to create peaks. We do need to create spaces for people to have valleys, to have time to reflect, to have quiet moments, to get rest. You know, we don't need to actually program everything from 7 a.m. until midnight and then hope that they show up fresh again at 7 a.m. But that's what happens, right? So we're so busy packing in our agendas, we're losing time for those important other things that have to happen for people to have an experience that is remarkable and memorable. So I think that if the whole world was doing a better job, if every event that you're not going to go to events every day, I go to an unusually high amount of events, but even people who go to a high amount of events, that might be 6 a year. You know, I think in our event industry, we have people who go to quite a lot more, but an average business traveler will go to 3 to maybe 6 events a year. And those 3 to 6 events might include continuing education credits that they require for their job. Yeah. And it might include, you know, time with peers and collaborators. It might include travel, or it might be more local. All of those things, you know, just because you're going to a 2-day event to get your continuing education credits for your highly professional organization doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy the time that you're there, you know? And in fact, anybody in any industry, you know, if my husband is a boiler safety inspector, if I went to his conference, I can't imagine anything more boring than sitting and talking about boiler safety. He comes home so rejuvenated from time spent talking to his peers about boiler safety regulations and code books, and apply that to any industry, right? So I want to talk about human science, like this, you know, the human behavioral science and leadership and change, and, you know, how we do, how we can impact all of those things. But every specialty, you know, but give them time and space to talk about those things. And they're going to leave feeling like, oh, I made a new friend. I shared an idea with somebody. I feel like I've, you know, I feel elevated and rejuvenated inside in the work that I've chosen, because I'm not alone in this work that I've chosen. Those are all things that we can do with events, is give people space for that time.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
Any organization that you work with always has a few of the same stumbling blocks, which always comes down to communication. And when we apply that to event and design thinking, it's how do you close that gap so that, what people are, saying and doing and thinking and feeling is all aligned, right? So it's, you're going in the same direction. Leadership has a vision. You need to bring people along to that.
You are listening to a Bizcast Audio Original. Podcasting is one of the fastest growing content marketing avenues today. We can help you exploit this largely untapped marketing opportunity. We can craft your audio strategy and leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that smartphone penetration provides. It is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to target audiences. Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for the Trade Show podcast and founder of PitchLink, the visitor engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode. What is the role? So let's go to the right at the beginning of the book. What is the role of design in this? And more importantly, these are not secrets, right, Tahira? I mean, it's not that, oh my God, I mean, I did a new discovery and there's a new molecule. No, these are things we know.
Yes.
My question is, why is this such a large gap between the knowing and doing? Why is it that we are not paying attention?
Yeah, that is such a good question. So in my other roles, I do two other things in addition to working on the content for IMEX. I own a company with two other co-founders that's called Strategy Table. And at Strategy Table, what we do is it's all about facilitation, change management, leadership thinking, workshopping around those kinds of things, which is new for us. The work for us isn't new. We've all been doing the work for about a decade, but the doing it together. We are working with organizations, and any organization that you work with always has a few of the same stumbling blocks, which always comes down to communication. Mm-hmm. And when we apply that to event and design thinking, it's how do you close that gap so that, what people are, saying and doing and thinking and feeling is all aligned, right? So it's, you're going in the same direction. Leadership has a vision. You need to bring people along to that. Change is always a bit uncomfortable. Events are a great way to bring together and allow people to have some of that change. The other thing that I do is I teach. And so I teach at the college level, and I have just started in January teaching again. And we've shifted to teaching not logistics and not how to do events, but the intentional event design. So, it's looking at what are all of those things. And that starts out with design. So how do we spend a small, teeny tiny part of our, 1%, if you looked at the event design collective's work, 1% of our time of an event should be spent on design. So if you have a small event, small amount of time planning the Olympics, which is a project they work on, a bigger amount of time, but still 1%, right? So how are you spending 1% of your time to think about what you want people to think, say, feel, do, and hear from your event? What's their entering behavior, and what do you want? What's the desired exit behavior? Spend a tiny bit of time on that at the beginning. And then start to layer in all of these other things. So how are you, embracing and embedding the technology that we have available to us today? How are you thinking about people arrive brain first, heart second, providing empathy, providing, how are we using color, sound, light, things that are at every event, but using them in ways that are enhancing the human experience and not interfering with the human experience. How can we use different types of seating space flow design? How can we use different types of learning and performance styles and sessions? And what's so fun for me is to watch these learners come in at the beginning, you know, and some of them are working in events, and some of them are trying to work in events and they're doing schooling towards that. Every single one of them is leaving these classes with just a renewed sense of, I have this amazing opportunity to help create change. And now I understand how I can do that better. And I understand how I can create the best human experiences. And I, you know, I have them all do a reflection form at the end. And like, I'm crying sometimes by the end, because you just see people who are able to implement very simple things. It's just, we're not taught them. We don't think about them. What we're taught, if we're taught anything, is how to do registration, learn these three technologies. Can you build a mobile app? Here's what a website should look like. Here's all the things it needs to include. Don't forget to order the food and beverage. And oh, by the way, you're also a legal expert and need to you know, manage all of these contracts. Oh, and you're a financial expert and have this $1 million budget. But nobody says, have you thought about the humans who are showing up? So there's definitely a gap there. And what's fun for me is that now two schools have recognized that gap, and that's where I'm teaching. And like I said, it's just incredible to see these people light up, and, you know, and to see the people who are responding to this book, who are working in events, and seeing them light up about it, because they're just like, oh, you know what, this is actually what I do. I create events for humans. And now I have ways to think about and talk to my senior leaders about why this matters so much. And now I can build some metrics around why this matters so much. You know, it's, events are the most expensive business marketing tool that you have, full stop. So, and they're the least measurable.
Yeah.
So, you know, you put out an A/B testing on a website, you put out A/B testing on an email. Oh, we, you know, 5,000 people opened it. Did they do anything with that? No. You bring 5,000 people into a room, you have the power to change their thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I wonder why we are not intentional, to take your words, and why organizers. So one of the things that I have a theory is that both organizers and exhibitors have their own bodies, right? Who represent and who talk and they think, right? There are none for attendees. So nobody is really voicing that, hey, we need to have X, or we are feeling that this is missing in what we did. I mean, we do the surveys, but they're not intentional from the attendees' point of view. I mean, if I've attended a place and you give me a survey, I mean, well, I want to take it. I'm half interested. I'm not so interested. I'll do a sort of shoddy job and give it back to you. I have no skin in that game of giving you information, because I'm not going to get anything out of it.
Well, and what you're going to remember, you know, I remember years ago, I was working on it was CEOs of health organizations. And there's 30 some people in the room. And we had this professor from MIT. It was long enough ago, he had an overhead projector. But, you know, one of the smartest people in organizational development in the world, from MIT, giving them a full day session. And at the end of the day, he gives out the evaluation. And he said, so I'm going to give you this evaluation. He said, and I'm going to tell you about what we do in my department at MIT, which is we collect all of those evaluations from. So in our department, everybody gets their evaluation, their summary results. We get our, you know, you get, as an instructor, you get all your evaluations back. So you can, you know, you can have conversations about them and all of that, improve. And so they have a dinner. Everybody at the dinner puts in $50. They all read out their worst evaluation. There's always a worst evaluation. And then they vote, and the winner with the worst evaluation gets the pot. And they do that every term. Because you know why? At the end of the day, that's what happens, is you get the best people either love you, or the people who really had something that they're angry about or didn't like or want to vent about, that's who fills in your surveys. What you don't get is all the people that had a mediocre experience.
Right. And that would be a large middle, right? That would be a large middle. Absolutely. So even customer, if you're looking at customer support data, that's really what comes out. I mean, who is going and leaving a review? Either the ones who are very happy, oh, I love the book, Tahira, or somebody who said, I mean, this is rubbish. Why was this book written? Et cetera, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Let's switch gear and talk about, you're talking about events being inclusive, right? And we are looking at a world which is now trying to say DEI is rubbish.
We're not looking at a world. Let's be clear about that. We are not looking at a world that says DEI is rubbish. And, you know, and I look at this from the perspective of, you know, I work on primarily right now two events. So for my entire career, you know, the first event that, the first very large event I worked on was 1996, the 11th International Conference on AIDS. 15,000 people coming to Vancouver. Too big for us, but at the time, now that would be no problem. But then it was, you know, difficult, just from a venue hotel perspective. And then 1,500 of those were people living with AIDS. And 1996 was the first year that antiretrovirals existed. So the amount of education that we had to do to even get an exhibit set up where people thought, well, if somebody lies on this thing, then I'm going to die. No, that's not how AIDS works. So we had to figure out how to include and educate people so that 1,500 people living with HIV and AIDS could come and participate in this conference. That's kind of inclusion at its max. That same year, there was an event at the convention center that was called Independence, and everybody at Independence was blind, deaf, mobility. There was, everybody had something, a challenge to being independent. So they had to, you know, build a little sand pit for the guide dogs. They had to, you know, do lots of things to think about how do we include people. And, you know, to include somebody who is vision impaired or deaf, requires some, well, particularly with deaf people, you know, are you going to add ASL interpretation? Are we going to add in, you know, some kind of translation, like a written translation that's in live time? What are some of those simple things that we can do? And we also now know that, you know, depending on, doesn't matter what kind of data you look at, 26% of the world is living with some kind of inclusion challenge. So yes, it could be mobility, vision, hearing, neuro inclusion, you know, just however you kind of want to extrapolate that out. And so inclusion, again, just comes back to empathy and considering that people are coming to your event and that people are in your life and that people are in your organizations. And that you're not, by accommodating, which is not the greatest word either, but by accommodating these needs, all we're doing is creating a place where more humans can connect. Why don't we want to do that? You know, everybody has something to contribute to the conversations that we're having. Everybody has something to, you know, a desire to be included. And most of those people are, anybody that I know or have interacted with in either my personal or professional life who has what we would call an inclusion challenge is incredible. They're working harder than somebody without a challenge. Yeah. And why are we not trying to just learn from those people and get better? And, you know, so planning, and so I was just gonna, so planning shows on two continents. You know, when we talk about, are we going to add, you know, EDI sessions into our, you know, to support people learning more about how to create inclusive events? Yes, we are. Do we look like we're a woke event? No, but we also need to remember that, like, Europe is such a different mentality. So when I first started, we were doing kind of Americanized programming for Europe, and that was long before this administration. But they just have a different approach to it and a different mindset around it. And so than North America. And so, you know, we can't, basically we can't lean into, I don't think. My opinion is we should be leaning in and learning from the people that we consider need some kind of inclusion. And we should be embracing all of the other things that they bring. There's so much data around how much better you can be as an organization, any organization, by being inclusive and welcoming and empathetic. And that it's unfortunate that we ever had to have DEI policies in place to allow people to see that and bring those people into their organizations. That those are being erased and that people are now having less awareness and opportunity to work with people that could be bringing a lot to them is really unfortunate. So when we talk about inclusion, I think about inclusion always about how can we make it so that it's the best experience for everybody. You know, we had an experience that I also write about in the book with Mayan Ziv, who's an amazing young woman. She started a festival this year in Toronto called Access Now. You know, we brought her to our event to speak. I was not, you know, basically I build the program and then I hand it over. And so we knew she was in a wheelchair. She knew she was coming with caregivers. And I see her first thing in the morning. I'm just like, oh, can I take you to your room? We walk down to her room. With her family, and we walk in the room, and there is a stage set up with no ramp, with a table that there's no possible way she can speak from. And it's 20 minutes till the session starts. And I'm just like, what the ever loving beep. So I just literally said to her, okay, I'm just going to stand here for just a moment and hang my head in shame. And then we're just going to figure out what we're going to do. And so, so we set up the panel on the floor. You know, the room wasn't too big. It was not ideal, and you know, both the moderator, Trevor and Mayan very graciously and gently, you know, said, this is my normal experience, unfortunately. And we were called out all day in this room by the moderator. And I said, yeah, we deserve that. Like 100%. We screwed up. We didn't pay attention. This is on us. Mm-hmm. So the next day she came upstairs and was speaking on a stage that did have a ramp, and she finished her talk, and you know, everybody did their Q&A, and they said, you know, are there any more questions? And I got up and I said, hi, I'm Tahira. We screwed up. Here to apologize publicly and for everybody in this audience to learn we can do better. You know, so, and she's so lovely about it, but you know, it's just, we need to be better.
Yeah.
The whole world needs to be better, you know? And so when you are in Google Maps and you see the accessibility where they, you know, where you're going through, if you're reviewing something, it will say, is this place accessible? That's because of the work Access Now has done with Google. Mm-hmm. But now around the world, you can do better. So, absolutely. You know, neuroinclusion, the same thing. We can do better. We can give people, we can create a quiet space. We have a few of them at IMEX. We can, as, you know, when we're doing facilitations, like we need to think about all of the different people in the room. Some people don't want to speak up. Some people do. Some people need different ways of being able to speak up. We want to make sure that all of the voices are heard. And so we're always working with different types of tools to make sure that that happens. So, you know, inclusion is something we have to think about every day, full stop.
That provides me a little bit of a segue and talk a little bit about the kind of tech that you see and you talk about in the book that is, you know, aiding in, you know, in fighting isolation or connection or even just getting excited about what is going on around.
I think that it's, I mean, it's about creating, you know, the spaces in between, right? So if we say, you know, the idea, there's this idea of the third place, right? So that we have you know, in, let's call it the olden days, you would go to cafe, you know, actually let's just call it Europe. So, you know, I spend about 6 weeks a year living in Europe, and actually I probably spend about 12 weeks a year living in Europe. And what happens there is people are used to living in smaller spaces. And so you do a lot of things out, you know, coffee shops are always busy. There's always people out. There's groups of people gathering. It's, that doesn't happen in Canada. In Canada, you go to your house, your family lives in your house with you. You stay in your house. You might have people over to your house.
Yeah.
But that whole socializing, you know, we just don't have that kind of cafe culture. But, you know, if we think about at events, you know, if a coffee break becomes a conversation cafe, if, you know, a hallway becomes a place of seeing and meeting, if, you know, you encourage people to stay out instead of kicking people out of a room, which we always do. Encourage people to stay for 30 minutes and continue the discussions. Like there's very, very, very simple things that we can do that we don't even consider quite often. So.
True. True. Fair enough. Let's touch upon this customer journey bit. And by the way, Tahira, if you want to talk about something specific in the book, you can do that.
No, I like the whole book.
Of course. Of course. So tell me about a bit about the customer journey and what that means. Is it about the journey once somebody has arrived at the event, or is it wider than that?
No, a customer journey starts from the time that you start marketing your event and start that anticipation phase. Of course, the thing most people most care about is what do I need to pack? So what, you know, what are the events going to, you know, be that I need to pack a specific thing to wear to it? Because they're excited about that, right? They want to participate in that. You know, so it starts from the anticipation phase and then it goes into the arrival. So who's greeting me at my arrival? What's my experience before I get to the place that I have to pick up my badge or scan my face or, you know, find my registration QR code, whatever it is. But making that arrival process smooth and welcoming. And there's lots of examples of that in the book of what to do and what not to do. And then there's the whole on-site experience. And then there's the follow-up. So which should be more than just a survey, you know, so how do you take that, you know, how do you continue that so people want to come back again? You know, TED is a good example of, you know, it started 30 some years ago. It is generally sold out before it ends. Other than, you know, they'll open up, like save some seats, obviously, for new people too. But, you know, and that's because they've built a community of people that want to be together year over year over year. And most events want to build a community that returns year over year over year. It's not really always practical just because, you know, people change jobs, they change lives, you know, things happen. But, you know, if you can have that some retention and growth, that's an ideal event scenario typically. But it has to be, you need to think about all of the touch points and not just like drop it as soon as it ends. Because if you just, then you're not building into that sort of remembering phase, and the remembering phase is what's going to bring you back the next year.
Absolutely. And it's incredibly hard to build a community. That's another thing. It's not that every organization or every event can actually actually do that. They can't.
No, it's they cannot. Very, very hard.
Yeah. However, what I do feel is that when I, again, talking to those attendees that I did, they said even the ability to stay engaged for a couple of months, not in an app, but a place where I could, you know, I'm going to a trade show and there are 500 booths. I mean, even if I'm there for 5 days, I'm not going to all the booths. I'm not looking at everything. I really don't know. And there has to be a way for me to go back to one of those booths which I didn't visit, but I was told by somebody else, hey, you should have taken a look at that. And there should be some way of communicating and connecting and so on. I mean, of course, I'm sort of extrapolating it into a completely different direction.
Yeah, I think that's where our technology and our apps can help us, right? So what did I miss? How can I connect? And then you're going to have to just be excited to come and see them the next year sometime. Yeah. So, and you also don't have a need to see every booth. You might have a need to see 10%, and that's perfect. Yeah. You know, that's kind of what marketplaces are built on. So, you know, if you go on Amazon, you're not trying to buy every product.
PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high quality engagement between buyers and sellers. Through its presentation and discussion modules, sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement process. PitchLink requires no installation or download, contains and manages the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without interruption. Connect with us on LinkedIn or visit TradeshowEngage.com. That is TradeshowEngage.com. This was a wonderful, wonderful conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. And thank you so much for coming and talking to us. And I hope to talk to you again.
Well, I would love that. This has been great. As I said, it's my favorite subject. And also, can I just say, I listened to some of the other conversations that have been on your podcast, and they're delightful. And there's a lot of learnings to be had for people. And I hope that they will listen to this and also go check out some of the other episodes you have.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes featuring great conversations on engaging your booth visitors and maximizing your ROI from your trade show investments. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening. Thank you for being with us today on the Trade Show Podcast, the podcast of record for the trade show and events industry. Here we talk to movers and shakers of the $50 billion trade show industry and identify ideas, challenges, tactics, and strategies to leverage the first-party intent inherent in the trade show business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and implement some of the ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of the Trade Show Podcast. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platform like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it. This is a Bizcast original podcast and is produced for PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Shubhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.